Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, November 8. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today we're expecting a partly cloudy day. Winds will be from the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour, and Cedar Rapids will see a high of 65. We'll climb to 66 in Iowa City, and then falling to a low this evening of 46 degrees in both cities. Sunset tonight is at 4:53 p.m., sunrise tomorrow morning at 6:49 a.m. for a total daylight period of 10 hours and 5 minutes. And from the front page of today's Gazette, deer strike get caught up as it enters week 4. Are the two sides about ready to declare an impasse? This is by Kara Smith of the Quad City Times in Davenport. As the UAW strike of the deer and company now heads into its fourth week, here's a roundup of happenings from the third full week of the strike. On day 17, which was Saturday, October 30, deer and the UAW reached a tentative agreement on day 17. Jen Hartman, director for public relations at deer, said the two sides have reached a second tentative agreement on a new six-year labor agreement covering approximately 10,100 production and maintenance employees at 12 facilities in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas. The first agreement was voted down October 10. Chuck Browning, UAW vice president and director of the Agricultural Implement Department, said the agreement contains economic gains and the highest quality health care benefits. On day 19, which was Monday, November 1, UAW workers returned to the picket lines, hours away from voting on the new tentative agreement. That offer included an immediate 10% increase in wages in the first year and an additional 5% in the third and fourth years. Some of that increase is tied to inflation through cost of living adjustments, which have the potential to change. On the off years, the second, fourth, and sixth years, workers would get a 3% lump sum payment. Upon ratification of the contract, workers would receive an $8,500 bonus. Workers would not pay any premiums for health care insurance, have no deductibles or co-insurance, and no changes in co-pays. Union members would get 2 weeks off 2 weeks of paid parental leave. The deal also included enhanced retirement benefits. On day 20, which was Tuesday, November 7, the UAW voted down the offer from Deere 55% to 45%. Through the agreements reached with the UAW, John Deere would have invested an additional $3.5 billion in our employees and, by extension, our communities to significantly enhance wages and benefits that were already the best and most comprehensive in our industries, said Mark A. Howes, a chief administrative officer for Deere. This investment was the right one for Deere, our employees, and everyone we serve together. Even though it would have created greater competitive challenges within our industries, we had faith in our employees' ability to sharpen our competitive edge. With the rejection of the agreement covering our Midwest facilities, we will execute the next phase of our customer service continuation plan. Brian Rothenberg, a spokesperson for the UAW, said, the strike against John Deere and company will continue as we discuss next steps with the company. Pickets will continue, and any updates will be provided through the local union. On day 21, which was Wednesday, November 3, Deere called the rejected offer the company's last, best, and final offer. Hartman said the company was proud of its six-year contract offer, which would have boosted pay and benefits for about 10,100 UAW workers. She said Deere informed the UAW that the ball is in their court. We will be communicating with the UAW, and there are conversations happening to make sure that that is understood and clear, we can move forward toward our first goal to get employees back to work, Hartman said. This is certainly a tough time of year for everyone, but we would like to see everyone back to work. A union member at Davenport Works said the offer didn't have everything, but probably would have been ratified if it was Deere's first offer. I think the company got a little greedy there with that first tentative agreement, and it backfired, and it ended up putting us out on strike because the agreement was so awful, the worker said. That kind of galvanized a lot of people's frustration for the last 20 years. Union members were also unhappy with the estimated increased wages tied to inflation through cost of living adjustments, especially considering the company's record profits in the past year. Workers want better pensions and guaranteed health care benefits in retirement, one said. Workers were concerned about gaps if they retired before they were eligible for Medicare. Deere said salaried workers would continue to step into plant roles to keep production moving. On day 22, Thursday, November 4, the UAW said Deere told media outlets the agreement was its final and best offer before it told that to unions. In our bargaining sessions with the UAW, both parties made numerous proposals in working to negotiate an agreement, Hartman said, when asked about the accusation. That meant both sides made concessions and compromises. In reaching the second tentative agreement with the union's bargaining committee, we advised that the overall value of the compensation and benefits package were as far as we were willing to go. The National Labor Relations Board requires an employer and unions to actively negotiate on employment terms until they agree on a labor contract or reach a standoff or impasse. An impasse is defined as a total breakdown of the bargaining process that occurs after good faith negotiations and exhausted perspectives, according to the NLRB. No formal process exists to declare an impasse, said Paul Iverson, labor expert at the University of Iowa's Labor Center. Both parties have to not be willing to make any additional offers. But if one party creates a new proposal, the other party is obligated to hear it, Hartman said. Deere and the UAW were still communicating. Iverson and Matt Pappas, an employment lawyer, said the terminology used by Deere, last, best, and final offer, is considered a term of art in negotiations. In labor relations, it typically indicates a company has reached an impasse, according to Iverson. Sometimes employers use the language as a precursor to arguing toward an impasse. Iverson said if the UAW indeed found out about Deere's final offer first through the media rather than at the bargaining table, it could potentially qualify as bad faith bargaining, depending on the circumstances. On day 23, Friday, November 5, as workers head into their fourth weekend on strike, some are preparing for an informal picket today outside the John Deere World Headquarters in Moline. Workers will gather outside one John Deere place at noon. The company has waged war against our membership and its families. It's time to unite our brothers and sisters and all locals worldwide, the announcement read. This is our last stand. We need you. The picket is not sanctioned by the UAW, and leaders urged members scheduled for official strike duties to attend those first. Also from today's front page, the University of Iowa Law School faces backlash over diversity question, a story by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette staff. A national nonprofit civil liberties group is calling on the University of Iowa College of Law to remove or revise a new question added to faculty evaluation forms asking how the professors have improved their law school's diversity, equity, and inclusion, calling those terms broad, subjective, and political. Incorporating such a question into faculty evaluations risks establishing an ideological litmus test for professors, which could impact promotion and tenure consideration and penalize faculty for holding a dissenting opinion on matters of public concern, asserted the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. The UI Law School added the question in fall of 2020 at the suggestion from an anti-racism committee formed in the wake of that summer's Black Lives Matter protests, and after University of Iowa College of Law Dean Kevin Washburn issued a statement committing to changes. At the College of Law, we embrace social justice as our responsibility, and we commit to making anti-racism an integral part of our work in the classes we teach, in the clinical and advocacy work we undertake, in the scholarship we produce, in the decisions we make, and in our everyday interactions within and without these walls, Washington Washburn wrote in June 2020. We also dedicate ourselves to examine systems and processes throughout the law school, ranging from curriculum and alumni support to outreach and community building, in order to guard against institutional racism and implicit bias. The faculty evaluation form now includes the following statement. The Iowa Law Anti-Racism Committee has encouraged me to ask each faculty member to identify any contributions you have made to improving our law school community in the areas of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Please do so. UI officials told FIRE, according to an email, that law college faculty aren't required to respond. But FIRE raised an eyebrow. If answering this question is optional, it certainly doesn't read that way, FIRE officials wrote in a statement. Not to put too fine a point on it, anyone working for a law school of all places would most certainly recognize this. In fact, while this prompt is one of several that faculty members may choose to respond to, it's the only one that ends with the language, please do so, suggesting that the response is mandatory. FIRE program analyst Sabrina Kanza, in a letter to Dean Washburn, went further in asserting that the prompt threatens discrimination. The text of the prompt leaves faculty members little assurance that their response, or lack of response, will be evaluated without respect to viewpoint, given the prompt's compulsory language and absence of sufficiently precise and objective definitions of diversity, equity, and inclusion, Kanza wrote on October 11. Absent more, these terms, which carry salient political connotations that are the subject of much debate and controversy, may serve as proxy for particular viewpoints or beliefs. In arguing diversity, equity, and inclusion have taken on political meaning, Kanza, in a 2020 letter to Washburn, suggested evaluating law school faculty on their contributions to patriotism, for example, would require an inherently political, viewpoint-dependent calculation. Kanza asked in the letter what would happen to a conservative professor who, believing his or her views aren't represented in the college, offered attending the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, as contributing to diversity of thought. Without clear, viewpoint-neutral definitions and metrics for the new evaluative criteria, Kanza argued, faculty members with personal or professional beliefs and commitments that differ from those of their peers or evaluators will be penalized. Washburn didn't respond to either of FIRE's letters in 2020 and this fall, prompting the organization to go public with its demands. At a minimum, Iowa law must amend the prompt to state clearly that it is voluntary and applicants won't be penalized for declining to answer, according to Kanza. The prompt should also expressly state that responses will not be evaluated on the basis of viewpoint. She offered an example of a prompt her organization would support. If interested, Please use this space to discuss any contributions you have made to the law school community in the areas of diversity and inclusion. Responses will not be evaluated on the basis of viewpoint, and there's no penalty for declining to respond. FIRE noted Iowa isn't the only institution adding diversity-related questions to faculty evaluations, pointing to the University of California at Los Angeles's mandate for a diversity statement from tenure-track applicants, and Cornell University's proposal to add diversity questions to course evaluations and promotion considerations. This trend shows no signs of slowing down, according to FIRE. In a statement to the Gazette, Washburn said legal education requires asking difficult questions and asking them often. I believe that our community and our nation need more conversation about important issues, not less, he wrote. I have repeatedly described Iowa law's diversity of faculty viewpoints to be one of the College of Law's greatest strengths. As a dean, it is incumbent upon me to encourage people to engage diverse people and views. Reiterating the evaluation addition is not a mandate, Washburn said he simply encouraged faculty introspection as to this question. While faculty are not required to respond, he said, the question has contributed to healthy discussion. Some professors have taken to social media defending the UI. The phrasing of the question at Iowa Law School is exactly as it should be. Faculties are asked what they have done to advance inclusivity, UC Davis School of Law professor Brian Suchek wrote on Twitter. It doesn't ask anything about what they believe. That's not viewpoint discrimination. Turning to today's insight or opinion page, we have a column by Norman Sherman entitled Approachable Joe, One Man, Two Parties. This is a piece by Sherman who lives in Coralville and who has worked extensively on politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary. That Senator Joe Manchin has been in the Senate since 2010 as a Democrat and now threatens to leave his party is more than just disloyalty. It is an insult to those, despite significant political differences, who worked to make sure he was heard. Yet, he now says that he is approachable by Republicans and might leave his party if he didn't get his way on President Joe Biden's social spending proposals. Manchin was elected to the Senate in 2010 and re-elected in 2016 as a Democrat. He has, in effect, a binding contract with 290,000 voters. Now he's prepared to ignore them, resurrect Mitch McConnell as majority leader, and make Republicans able to thwart more easily every administration-proposed program. What Manchin seemed to want was capitulation and not compromise. There's a difference. Negotiating in good faith is what the Senate is all about. Another senator at another time explained, compromise is not a dirty word. The Constitution itself represents the first great national compromise. In a democratic, pluralistic society, legislation ought to be a compromise of differing points of view and of different interests. The senator who uttered those words was an ardent liberal, a passionate advocate for progressive programs who often depended on Republican senators to get things passed. He found a way always to stand up for what he believed, but he listened to those in both parties who disagreed. Hubert Humphrey never insisted his way was the only way. He held strong views and wasn't shy about expressing them in debate and in legislation. He was the most visible liberal from his election in 1948 to his death in 1978 on civil rights, arms control, education, and health care. He muted his words, avoided needless confrontation, compromised with integrity, and never deserted his principles. Manchin, among other things, objects to the family leave section, which says an eligible employee may take job-protected leave to take care for a child of any age, spouse, domestic partner, parent, grandparent, grandchild, or sibling with a serious health condition. We are among a handful of nations without it. The original proposal was for 12 weeks, but had been cut in compromise to 4 weeks. Manchin seemed to accept that until he didn't. Now he wants it out. Newspaper reports said, but the party's liberal bloc ultimately had no choice but to scale back some of its ambitions. Another report summed it up. Joe Manchin is the deciding vote on President Biden's Build Back Better agenda and is refusing to support it. They have given in to him. They have gone more than halfway. Nothing is enough on his sliding scale. Clearly, Joe Manchin is deaf to the voices of his Democratic colleagues. Maybe he can hear Senator Humphrey, who said, "The moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped." That is the Family Leave Act. That is the Biden agenda. That piece by Norman Sherman of Coralville. And we have two community letters today. The first comes from Angela Wieland of Cedar Rapids. Her letter is entitled, "Dental Care Needs Funding." Recently, President Joe Biden announced that dental care expansion may be taken out of the reconciliation package before Congress. As a dental health care worker, it's been really frustrating to see this pandemic affect our health care system and then turn around and see our leaders try to separate dental from overall health. Are our teeth not a part of our body? Medicaid recipients are in a particularly bad situation, with many local clinics not accepting Medicaid. What can people who are Medicaid recipients do when they have dental issues? This problem is only getting worse, as Iowa is projected to get up to 14,000 new recipients in November and December alone because of the pandemic. We need local leaders and elected officials to support our smiles. Dental should be addressed by the Cedar Rapids City Council and the Linn County Board of Supervisors. Part of the federal money from the American Rescue Plan should support people caring for their dental health. We need to support clinics that accept Medicaid patients and help more people get dental care. This pandemic has made it hard to find a reason to smile. Elected officials of Linn County and Cedar Rapids can make it possible. That letter by Angela Wieland of Cedar Rapids. And our next letter comes from Debbie Koopman of Cedar Rapids. Her piece is entitled, "Congress Must Support Quality Child Care." With 37 years of experience as a child care director in Cedar Rapids, I understand the need to subsidize child care. I have worked for both corporate and private child care. Both put the needs of children first. Quality care aids childhood development and gives those children an advantage as they enter elementary school. Staff who work these jobs take on a huge responsibility, dealing with children's personal growth and the parents' needs on a daily basis. These jobs are essential and deserve dignity and respect. Our community benefits when we have quality child care. The COVID-19 pandemic pushed a fragile business to the brink of collapse. Each center still is fighting to keep parents and children safe and cared for despite financial stress. Child care is a building block of a strong economy. Without qualified staff to work, centers have to reduce the number of children they can enroll. If we want to help those parents who need to return to work, we need to support the Build Back Better agenda and the child care provisions in the framework. This cycle will rebuild the economy on the foundation of a care economy. I'm calling on my members of Congress to support the Build Back Better plan, which will help ease the burden of high costs of child care on working families and make investments in children and caregiving. Child care is fundamental to our shared values of family and community, and we can't afford to not pass this transformative legislation. That piece by Debbie Koopman of Cedar Rapids. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, November 8, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Cedar Rapids, Margaret Dodge, age 94, died Thursday, November 4, at the Living Center West Nursing Home in Cedar Rapids. Arrangements are pending with the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. From Cedar Rapids, Dennis Murphy. The funeral for Dennis Murphy is to take place at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 10, at St. Pius Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, with a visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Also from Cedar Rapids, Ellen E. Ellis, age 90, died on Friday, November 5, after a lengthy illness. Services are through Iowa Cremation. Interment will be at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Ellen requested that there be no services. And from Loudoun, Barbara Ann Schroeder Kramer died peacefully on November 5, at the age of 82, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. A visitation will be held from 5:30 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, November 10, at the Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, November 11, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Lost Nation. Burial will follow in the Lost Nation Cemetery. From Marion, Glenn Wilkinson, age 67, lost his battle with brain cancer on Saturday, November 6, at his home. A celebration of life will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, November 12, at the American Legion Post 298 at 625 31st Street in Marion. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Patricia, also known as Tricia Stork, age 70, passed away on Friday, November 5, at St. Luke's Hospital. She chose to be a donor through the Iowa Donor Network to help improve the lives of others. A celebration of life gathering will take place in Iowa as well as in Kansas City at a later date. The Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services of Mount Vernon is caring for Tricia and her family. And from Wellman, Linda Ann Mutchler, age 74, passed away on November 3 in Wellman. Linda's family will receive guests from noon to 2 p.m. Wednesday, November 10, at the Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service at 2720 Muscatine Avenue in Iowa City, followed by a graveside committal service at Memory Gardens Cemetery. And in other death notices, from Atkins, Mary Freese, age 74, died Friday, November 5. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is caring for the family. From Elgin, Laverne Anthony Imel, age 86, died Friday, November 5. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Elgin is assisting the family. From Luana, Evan Michael Pape, age 38, died Thursday, November 4. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Monona is assisting the family. And from Maquoketa, Travis Bickford, age 48, died Friday, November 5. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is assisting the family. And from Marion, Linda C. McCormick, age 78, died Thursday, November 4. The Iowa Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From North English, Gerald T. Allison, age 86, died Saturday, November 6. The Powell Funeral Home in North English is assisting the family. From Riverside, Rick Noel, age 64, died Friday, November 5. The Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City is assisting the family. From Vinton, Stephen Boddicker, age 72, died Saturday, November 6. The Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton is assisting the family. From Waukon, Jeanette A. McCormick, age 84, died Thursday, November 4. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is assisting the family. From Wheatland, Charles Doty, age 93, died Sunday, November 7. The Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence is assisting the family. And from Williamsburg, Ruth M. Shanahan, age 94, died Saturday, November 6. The Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg is assisting the family. And in other deaths, Dana Leonard, age 67, of Rock Island, Illinois, died Thursday, November 4. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is assisting the family. Turning to today's sports page, we have a story about Iowa, University of Iowa football, entitled Probably Padilla, a story by John Stepp of the Gazette staff. Alex Padilla's job as backup quarterback, as he sees it, is to prepare like the starter every week. You never know when you're going to get the opportunity, Padilla said. For the first three drives Saturday night, the Northwestern game wasn't any different from the dozens of other games since he enrolled in 2019. He was wearing the same red hat and headset that he always adorns as the backup quarterback. Then he heard on the headset, "I kind of hear everything that's going on," something out of the blue. It was his turn at quarterback. Unlike all the other games, Saturday quickly became more than just preparing like the starter. He played like a starter, too. Although Spencer Petras technically earned the start, Padilla came in after three drives and gave the Hawkeyes a much-needed jolt on offense and was responsible for almost 90% of the team's passing attempts. Alex stepped in and did a really good job, Iowa head coach Kirk Ferentz said. He completed 18 of 28 throws for 172 yards. He didn't have any touchdowns, but he didn't have any interceptions either. Padilla also showed some skills that transcend box scores, including extending plays with his feet. Ferentz said the Hawkeyes really didn't change the game plan an awful lot for Padilla. "He's, I think, pretty comfortable with everything we're doing," Ferentz said. Padilla definitely had some nerves, he said, although he knew he had a great group of guys around me that made my job easy. While the move caught Padilla by surprise, the team knew Petras was not 100% healthy after Wisconsin. Coming into the week, we knew Spencer was a little dinged up, freshman wide receiver Keegan Johnson said. Petras suffered an injury as he took a hit against the Badgers. Running back Tyler Goodson said it had to do with his shoulder and was nursing it throughout the week, Ferentz said. "He couldn't throw it, not with zip on it," Ferentz said. The energy Petras couldn't expend on the field instead went into helping Padilla. "He really rallied around me," Padilla said. "He was giving me a whole bunch of tips because this is kind of my first real action at Iowa," Padilla frequently connected with the two true freshman wide receivers, Johnson and Arland Bruce IV. Johnson had a team-high 5 receptions for 68 yards and 11 targets. Bruce had 3 receptions for 30 yards. They didn't get a whole lot of reps at the beginning of the season, so they were running with the second team, and I had a lot of work with them, Padilla said. "I have great chemistry with them." That chemistry from working on the second team together was one of the main things that played into our success, Johnson said. Padilla's first two 15-plus yard completions went to Johnson. "Anytime I have a one-on-one with Keegan, who's obviously a great player, I'm very confident that he can make a play for our team," Padilla said. One of the other stars from Saturday's game, linebacker Dane Belton, came to Iowa in the same recruiting class as Padilla. "He's one of the guys that you can trust to get the job done," Belton said. Job done indeed. He did the job so well that Ferentz did not commit to a starting quarterback going forward once Petrist is healthy. We'll look at the film, see what we think, Barron said. Spencer's led us to a lot of victories, and tonight, Alex did. Here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled, Cheating Husband Obsesses Over Cheating Wife's Lover. Dear Abby, my wife and I have been married for 21 mostly happy years. However, last year I had an affair that lasted for several months. I confessed to my wife and we separated for about a month while I tried to evaluate what I should do. In the end, I returned home and asked for forgiveness and reconciliation. Obviously, my wife has struggled with my infidelity, but to her credit, she's trying hard to make things work. During our separation, we had little contact, and she told me that for revenge, she had slept with someone else. I know that what's good for the goose is good for the gander, but the guy is less than half our age, and I'm struggling with the mental image and thoughts of trying to match his level of stamina and energy, if you know what I mean. I know I messed up, but I love my wife with my whole heart, and I'm working hard to demonstrate it. How do I purge my thoughts of the image of my wife with another man? And that's signed Remorseful in California. And Abby responds, it may not be easy. Don't you think your wife has had similar mental images of you and the woman you cheated with? Infidelity hurts everyone involved. You and your wife are working to remain reunited. Concentrate on that rather than preoccupy yourself with your insecurities, and you'll be better off. Here's a story from the Iowa Today section. It's entitled, Iowa City Fire Chief Retiring After Nearly 30 Years with the City. John Greer reflects on what he's most proud of and what's next. A story by Isabella Zaluska of the Gazette staff. John Greer had no intention of becoming a firefighter, but the timing was right, and it led him to a nearly 30-year career with the Iowa City Fire Department. Growing up, he lived a block from the fire station in Canton, Illinois, where his father was fire chief. Even though he was always around the fire station, he didn't think it was something he wanted to pursue as a career. He graduated from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign with a degree in psychology and began working as a certified mental health counselor. But there was a volunteer fire department nearby, and Greer signed up with a friend to volunteer. He thought maybe it was something he wanted to pursue after all. While getting his firefighter certification, Greer met two people from Iowa City who encouraged him to take the entrance exam. I was testing all over Illinois, too, so I was on a number of eligibility lists, Greer said. Iowa City was the first one that called, so I picked up and moved over here. Greer's first day as a firefighter with the Iowa City Fire Department was August 10, 1992. Nearly 30 years later, the fire chief is retiring in February. I feel like I'm leaving the department in a good place and to let somebody else pick it up and take it from here, Greer said, adding that his time at the department seems to have gone by quickly. Greer started as a firefighter and climbed the ranks, serving as lieutenant, captain, battalion chief, and fire marshal before being selected as chief in 2013. He also worked part-time as a paramedic for Johnson County Ambulance Services for more than 20 years. I got to do a little bit of everything here, said Greer, age 57. Reflecting on his 29-year career, Greer said there are a number of things he's proud of, including getting a new training facility for the department after the previous one was closed due to development in the Riverfront Crossings District. He also said he's proud of the department's top-notch equipment and vehicles, as well as acquiring land for a fifth fire station. During his time as chief, Greer said call volume has certainly increased. The department is projecting 8,000 calls this year, Greer said. In 2019, the fire department responded to 7,430 calls for service. Greer said he's grateful to his mentors, including previous Fire Chief Andy Rocha. He said he's fortunate to have worked with previous City Manager Tom Marcus and current City Manager Jeff Fruin. I hope people have the same experience here that I did and that they still enjoy coming to work, Greer said. He said he's looking forward to the next thing, which includes moving to Bradenton, Florida, to be closer to his parents, spending more time with his family, relaxing and traveling. Greer's retirement will be effective February 11, Fruin said in an email. The recruitment schedule aligns with Greer's planned last day. The city posted a job opening for a fire chief on October 5 that closes this coming Friday. The fire chief is appointed by the city manager and approved by the Civil Service Commission and the Iowa City Council. The chief is responsible for an annual operating budget of $9.2 million and a sworn staff of 63 employees, according to the job listing. Candidates are required to have a bachelor's degree or equivalent in business, public administration, or fire science. More than 7 years of experience in fire and rescue management is required, as well as a valid driver's license. The chief hired must live in Iowa City. The starting salary for the position ranges from $100,276.80 to $158,912, according to the job listing. And from today's community page, Bigger Space and Plans, Coralville Food Pantry is raising funds for a new building and more features, a story by Isabella Zaluska of the Gazette staff. The Coralville Community Food Pantry is about halfway to its goal of raising $1.2 million for a customized building twice the size of its current space. The food pantry has been working with its top supporters for the past 9 months and went public with its fundraising campaign in October. The More Than a Pantry campaign has raised close to $650,000, Executive Director John Bowler said. We definitely are leaning on our community members to help us get to that finish line and make sure that we can get our next goal met in the next couple of months, Bowler said. The Coralville Food Pantry opened in 2009 and was run by volunteers for the first few years, Bowler said. He was brought on board in 2012 as the pantry's first paid staff person. The pantry has operated out of the former Coralville Post Office for the past 6 years. This location at 1002 Fifth Street never was intended to serve as a permanent home, Bowler said. Longtime partners at the Coralville United Methodist Church gifted land for the new 5,000 square foot building. The new food pantry will be built on the empty lot attached to the church at 106 13th Avenue. The location is within walking distance to the Coralville Rec Center and Northwest Junior High. There will be parking spaces as well as a bus stop on the corner. The need for extra space is more obvious than ever in the last 18 months, Bowler said. Throughout the pandemic, Bowler said the food pantry saw an increase of about 15% in total families served. The pantry served 1,162 families in 2020. This year, the pantry continues to see pretty consistently a lot of first-time visitors, Bowler said. We're still seeing a lot of Coralville residents who are just really struggling financially, and two, folks who are kind of on the higher end of the spectrum of being food insecure, who really rely on us multiple times a week, Bowler said. In addition to having more dry and cold food storage space, the building will have a larger welcome area and pantry shopping area, which will allow more people to come in at a given time, Bowler said. Other features include an educational garden, outdoor cooking space, and access to the church kitchen. Bowler said the pantry could become a one-stop shop. There are also discussions of collaborating with nonprofits or community groups to offer mobile health clinics, cooking classes, and entrepreneurial support. We envision so much exciting and innovative programming that could come out of that space, especially the kitchen, Bowler said. adding that the pantry would like to launch a hot meal program. We want people to feel that they're at home, they're welcome, that they don't need to feel ashamed to come and visit a food pantry, because we are just a welcoming space that makes everybody feel equal and at home. The $1.2 million building is being designed by Newman Monson Architects and will be constructed by Hodge Construction. Bowler said groundbreaking is planned for early December, and the new space could have its doors open by the fall of next year. And we have three Eastern Iowa briefs today, the first coming from Cedar Rapids, entitled Toy Donations for Kids in Foster Care Needed for a Holiday Event. Families Helping Families of Iowa is collecting toys and coordinating volunteers for its Winter Wonderland holiday celebration on December 11. FHF hosts an annual holiday party for more than 1,000 members of the foster care community. This free, festive event includes gifts, food, crafts, Santa Claus, a visit to Santa's workshop, and more. FHF needs help collecting brand new toys and gift cards. If you would like to purchase toys or gift cards for the event, a suggested value of $25 is appreciated. A list of gift ideas can be found on FHF's website at www.fhfia.org, where donations such as toys or financial donations also can be made. Donations will be collected through December 3 and can be delivered to the FHF office at 6000 7th Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids. FHF is also seeking volunteers to help on the day of the event. If you would like to volunteer, call 319-294-9706 or email office at fhfia.org. Pre-registration to the holiday celebration is required. Foster parents and caregivers can register their families at www.fhfia.org. From Decorah, Vesterheim Online Lecture Series looks at military contributions. Vesterheim, the National Norwegian American Museum and Folk Art School, continues free online presentations this month connected with the new exhibit entitled Innovators and Inventors. The lecture series brings together some of the most creative and inspiring Norwegian American leaders, thinkers, and artists working today, and the two November sessions focus on historic innovation. Visit Vesterheim.org to register for the Zoom links. Today at 7 p.m., Jamie Holmes will recount the dramatic story of the scientists of Section T, headed by Dr. Merle Tuve, and their work to develop the proximity fuse, which was an invaluable asset to the Allies in World War II. Holmes is the author of 12 Seconds of Silence, how a team of inventors, tinkerers, and spies took down a Nazi superweapon. On November 15 at 7 p.m., learn more about the important Norwegian-American brothers, Merle A. and Richard L. Tuve, that's T-U-V-E, from Merle's daughter, Lucy Tuve Comley, and Richard's daughter, Christine Tuve Burris. The Tuve brothers made significant contributions to the fields of physics and chemistry that were of critical importance during World War II. Merle's discoveries led to the development of radar technology and the proximity fuse for military weapons. Richard worked to increase the survival rate of military personnel stranded in the ocean. The exhibit, Innovators and Inventors, celebrates the creativity and ingenuity of Norwegian immigrants and their descendants in America. And from Jackson County, help remove invasive species from Ozark Prairie on Wednesday. Join Jackson County Conservation at 10 a.m. Wednesday to help out with some of the area's rarest and most impaired habitats, the remnant prairie. Invasive and woody species threaten this rare ecosystem, and the removal of these threats is vital. Jackson County conservation staff and volunteers will help remove invasive and woody species from Ozark Wildlife Area's remnant prairies. Volunteers will get a chance to experience a rare and fragile ecosystem. Hand tools will be provided. Volunteers are asked to wear long pants and closed-toed shoes, and to bring plenty of water. For registration or questions, contact Tony Vorwald at tony@jacksonccb.com. The group will meet, carpool, and caravan from the Hurstville Interpretive Center at 18760 63rd Street in Maquoketa at 10 a.m. on Wednesday. And from Things to Do Today, a museum exhibit entitled Band 141, 140 Years of Hawkeye Marching Excellence. You can view a significant collection of materials from the Hawkeye Marching Band's history, including photographs, drill charts, papers, scrapbooks, uniform pieces, audio and video recordings, and more. It's from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. at the Voxman Music Building at 93 East Burlington Street in Iowa City. The cost is free, and it's for all ages. And another museum exhibit entitled Art to Eat By, Cookbooks as a Record and Expression. Food as art has long been tied to the enjoyable and meaningful experience of dining. This exhibit shows that books about food often have attempted to navigate the personal, familial, and domestic spaces of dining while displaying a public-facing image of those experiences. This goes from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Special Collections and Archives Reading Room, the third floor, at the University of Iowa Libraries at 125 West Washington Street. The cost is free, and it's for all ages. And an educational activity entitled Singing Bowl Prayer at Prairie Woods. Throughout history, singing bowls have been used to foster meditation, relaxation, prayer, and mind-body-spirit wellness. Let the resonant sounds of Himalayan and crystal singing bowls relax the entire body and create a pathway for clearer connections. You can register by noon at www.prairiewoods.org or call 319-395-6700. This is from 12:45 to 1:30 p.m. today at the Prairie Woods Franciscan Spirituality Center at 120 East Boyson Road in Hiawatha. The cost is $5, and it's for all ages. And a literary activity entitled Pause to Read. This popular reading program pairs emerging readers with Certified Therapy International dogs. Pull up a book and a dog and let the magic begin. It's from 6:30 to 7 p.m. at the Hiawatha Public Library at 150 West Wilman Street. The cost is free, and it's for all ages. And finally, we have a musical activity entitled Musicians Take Note, a Cedar Rapids Community Orchestra. Reconnect with the camaraderie of fellow musicians who played in high school or college orchestra. All may join. No auditions are required. It's from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Cedar Hills Community Church at 6455 E Avenue Northwest in Cedar Rapids. The cost is free, and it's for all ages. And our pet of the week is Dottie Minerva. Dottie Minerva is a roughly 1 to 2 year old, 40-pound Labrador Retriever and a Terrier mix, available for adoption at the Cedar Rapids Animal Care and Control at 7241 Washington View Parkway. Dottie came to the shelter as a stray, but appears to have had some house training and has done well with other dogs while at the shelter. Call 319-286-5993 to set up an appointment or for more information. And from our top stories page, Vilsack, : Biden not going after livestock, a story by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Reducing the number of livestock will not be a priority for the Biden administration as it seeks to drastically cut methane emissions to stem cultural climate change, according to U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. Instead, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Climate Smart initiatives will focus on new types of animal feed and manure management. There's a multitude of ways in which we can help the livestock industry, regardless of what type of livestock we're talking about, Vilsack told Iowa Capital Dispatch last week. We have to be aggressive. We can't ignore it. We can't stick our heads in the sand. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas that, along with carbon dioxide, is believed to be a driving force of the planet's warming climate. The new global methane pledge seeks to cut methane emissions by 30% this decade. And cattle are the top source of methane in agriculture. One cow can belch more than 200 pounds of methane each year, according to researchers at the University of California at Davis. There were about 3.7 million cattle and calves in Iowa as of January. Livestock waste also emits methane as it decomposes. Earlier last week, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, was skeptical that agricultural methane emissions could be reduced without hurting farmers. How are you going to stop cattle from pooping? You can't put diapers on cattle, Grassley said last week during a call with Iowa reporters. If they're going after animal agriculture, they're going to look silly. But Vilsack, who was Iowa's governor for 8 years, said specialized diets can reduce methane production in cattle stomachs. For example, researchers at the University of New Hampshire have found a partial seaweed diet can cut methane emissions from cows. With due respect to the senator, this administration is not going after animal agriculture, Vilsack said. It's protecting animal agriculture. He said repeatedly that the administration does not have plans to shrink livestock populations. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, November 8. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.